We have to learn and from those narratives, because it's also very much a war of narratives, of a war of stories. It's a war of propaganda.
It was Nashmalina Khan speaking with Dr. Ipenki on Habibti Please. Find new episodes at habibtiplease.substack.com or wherever you get your podcasts, and at harbingermedianetwork.com. You're listening to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. Coming up next. Since launching in May 2023, Perspectives, the Broadbent Institute's Journal of Political Economy and Social Democracy, has brought left-wing thought and inquiry into public debates and policy for building a more just and equitable Canada. On this excerpt from a new episode, the Parkland Institute's Mac Penner in Calgary and host Clem Nokos in Toronto discuss how Mark Carney has become the new political face of an ideological orientation that seems to share his Western Canadian background, but none of his partisan identifications. Now, here's the show.
And in that sense, I think that we see the Carney government, you know, if you want to use a word like internalizing, I think it's sort of fair, internalizing this view of the state that says the state isn't really there to improve our collective lives in any sort of general sense. What we should expect the state to do is sort of grease the wheels of the capitalist train or something like this. And beyond that, I don't think that the Carney government sees all that much value in the things that the state does.
Welcome to Perspectives, a Canadian Journal of Political Economy and Social Democracy. I'm Clement Nokos, editor of Perspectives Journal and director of policy at the Broadbent Institute. In the summer 2025 issue of Perspectives Journal, which you can now find in print and online, University of Calgary postdoc and Parkland Institute board member Mac Penner wrote an article entitled "Carney and the Calgary School, or Passive Revolution, and Canada's Social State in the Neoliberal Era." Penner traces the origins of Prime Minister Mark Carney's economic thinking to the Calgary School, which he describes as an informal grouping of conservative academics that played an active and a significant role in influencing Canadian politics during the 1990s and 2000s, whose members centered around the University of Calgary. What united otherwise disparate neoliberal and neoconservative thinkers at the Calgary School was a skeptical orientation towards the intentional state. Carney, a lifelong banker in the financial investment sector, then the monetary central banking sector, thus stands quite appropriately as an heir to North American neoliberalism. But to secure his troubled inheritance with impressive stealth, he has become the new political face of an ideological orientation that shares his Western Canadian background, but none of his partisan identifications. Strange and contradictory as it seems, Carney arguably represents the common sensification of a conservative tradition identified with the Calgary School, a now multi-generational group of conservative intellectuals, of which none would appreciate the association with the Liberal government. To better understand this connection between Carney and the Calgary School, I'm joined by Mac Penner. Thank you for chatting with me on the Perspectives Journal podcast.
Thanks, Clement. Very good to be here with you.
So the Calgary School to me seems like some sort of CanCon invention, a sort of lesser-known school of conservative thought localized for the Canadian context and compared to more impactful schools like the Chicago School, which promulgated neoliberal thought around the world. Today, at the time of recording, is September 11th. And in 1973, on this day, we saw the coup in Chile against the Salvador Allende socialist government that brought in the Pinochet dictatorship, who also then brought in the Chicago Boys to implement a neoliberal economic regime in that country for decades. You also have the new left intellectualism of the Frankfurt School, which informs a lot of the thought we have in today's social democratic discourse. You call it something of an informal grouping of conservative academics based out of the University of Calgary, but could you speak more to what the Calgary School was? Is this actually something distinct from the Chicago School, which also espoused seemingly similar beliefs and political influence?
Yeah, so I think this will be really helpful to sort of sort through the way that the Calgary School sits alongside these other probably more famous, arguably more impactful schools. So just in the first place, to do some sort of biographical introduction for the Calgary School. When I talk about the Calgary School, I'm really talking principally about a core group of five academics, all of whom worked at the University of Calgary. They started arriving there as early as the late 1960s, but they sort of started to make noise such that they were noticed by the Canadian public, figures in media, and so on, as of the early 1990s. And so probably their most active decade is this period from the early 1990s through to the early 2000s, when the conservative movement sort of comes back together again in Canada after it splintered in the 1980s as the Reform Party rose. And so this core group of five consists in the first place of four political scientists. These names will be familiar to people who followed Canadian politics in the last several decades. So the political scientists are Barry Cooper, Tom Flanagan, Reiner Knopf, and Ted Morton. And then rounding out the group of five is a historian, David Berkeson. So that's sort of the core group. These are the people or the personnel that I'm talking about if I talk about the Calgary School. And so you're right to sort of suggest that it's at least worth asking the question as to whether the Calgary School deserves to sit alongside these other schools. So let's sort of just take analogous schools that we associate with right-wing politics as a way to do this. So if you think back, say, to the early 20th century and something like the Austrian School, you have a school of economics which is associated with the marginal revolution in the way that people did economics. And so the theme that's going to sort of come up here if we run through these schools is that for whatever reason, right-wing politically associated schools tend to be schools of economics. So it's true of the Austrians. If you take the Freiburg School or the German Ordo-Liberals, as they're often called, they're associated with a kind of economic constitutionalism. If you go to the States and take the Virginia School, perhaps, again, associated with public choice theory as developed by James Buchanan at the University of Virginia. And then the same is true, of course, of Chicago. It's a little bit more difficult with Chicago to talk about like a really particular kind of contribution to professional economics, just because of the way that the Chicago School is now this multi-generational formation with extensive sort of influence in U.S. and even global politics, as you've already alluded to. But even so, if we were going to talk about the Chicago School, we would probably just highlight something like neoclassical economics and the privileging of the free market in the way they did economics. And so none of this is possible with the Calgary School in the first instance, because again, the Calgary School is not a school of economics. It's principally a school of political science. You'll even hear people refer to the Calgary School of Political Science as a sort of more specific way to talk about the Calgary School. So what the Calgary School needs in order to sit sort of in a worthy kind of way alongside these other schools is some sort of shared fundamental orientation. And I think as it happens that they actually did have that. So the way that I like to talk about this is to say that the Calgary Schoolers shared in their critique of the intentional state. This idea of an intentional state is an imposition that I put upon them. It's not something that they ever talked about themselves, but I think that it does sort of get at the way that the Calgary Schoolers thought about the state, which is sort of the key thing that I think held the group together. So then in a nutshell, if you like, the intentional state or an intentional state is any state that acts in the service of preconceived outcomes or goals. So just as a way to sort of give some examples, a state that sets about to reduce economic inequality, or a state that would concern itself, say, with race-based affirmative action, or a state that wants to address some sort of gender imbalance or lack of parity, say, in gender pay equity or something like this. All of these kinds of things would be examples of intentional state action, the likes of which the Calgary Schoolers would oppose. And it's also, I think, worth saying that the Calgary Schoolers themselves don't come to this viewpoint in identical ways. So they train sort of in different traditions and inherit this way of thinking in somewhat different ways. So this is kind of an alliance of fellow travelers, if you like, rather than ideologically identical thinkers. So in the case of the older, just to talk about the political scientists in the Calgary School for now, in the case of the older two, so that's Tom Flanagan and Barry Cooper, they really come to this most of all through what we could call the neoliberal intellectual tradition. Both of them were very influenced by a political philosopher called Eric Voegelin, who's not that well known. But especially in the case of Flanagan, it's worth talking about the influence of Friedrich Hayek, who is much better known, sort of known to be this paragon of the neoliberal intellectual movement. And reading Hayek, Flanagan in particular gets a critique of what Hayek called constructivism, or the constructivist state. Hayek made this very famous, especially to the wider public, when he published a book called The Road to Serfdom in 1944, I believe, in which he argued effectively that any state that acted in these kind of intentional ways, again, he wouldn't have used this formulation of the intentional state, but effectively he describes an intentional state and then says any state doing that is a state on the road to totalitarianism, or something like this. And of course, that became sort of a well-known Cold War critique of the left from the right. And so something like constructivism, and Hayek is where Flanagan gets this, the younger two political scientists in the Calgary School, Knopf and Morton, train in rather a different kind of context. Both of them trained at the University of Toronto in the 1970s with a couple of expatriate Straussian political scientists. Alan Bloom is the better known of the two. Walter Burns was the other one. Both of them had trained in Chicago with Leo Strauss at the University of Chicago. And Strauss, again, was a very sort of famous political philosopher, sort of known like a father of sorts in the neoconservative movement. And Strauss, for his part, would have lamented the quest to implement a simply rational society. So like excess rationalism or something would be the way that Strauss would make a similar point to the one that Hayek made, and that, you know, of course, in these later decades, the Calgary School made in a Canadian context. And then it's also kind of just to sort of finish this account of what the Calgary School critique of the intentional state looked like. It manifested in a way that I call antisocial, a kind of antisocial statism, because in practice, this is a way of thinking about the state that was marshaled against the post-war welfare state or the social welfare state as it developed in Canada. So the Calgary School view of Canadian history in the 20th century is one that sees things going roughly fine until, say, 1945 and the end of the Second World War. And you could, there are lots of paradoxes that come up here, so we could talk about this all day long. But in any case, they see sort of a declinist or declensionist narrative from 1945 as that welfare state grows in the post-war years. And as of the 1990s, they're saying, all right, enough of this. It's time to sort of leave this way of thinking about the state behind and do something new. And then finally, just to sort of to address the first part of your question about whether or not the Calgary School is a CanCon invention, I think that's totally fair to put it in that way. And in some sense, the Calgary School had to be sort of named into existence in Canada in order for it to sort of take on this meaning or status that we ascribe to it now. So there it's worth saying that it was in like the late 1980s when a guy called Ralph Hedlund is sort of floating this idea that something like the Calgary School exists in the Alberta Report, which is a conservative news magazine based in Alberta. But then this idea that, you know, there's really something going on in Calgary becomes much better known to the Canadian public in January of 1992, when Jeffrey Simpson, a journalist and a columnist in the Globe and Mail, publishes an article that says there's a Calgary mafia, his terms, active at the University of Calgary. Of course, the mafia label hasn't stuck, but certainly from that point in the early 1990s, it's been fairly commonplace to talk about something like the Calgary School.
Yeah, no, I find a group of academics taking part in organized crime is something unbelievable. Maybe a school is more apt in that description. But in any case, in your article, you also refer to the Federal Liberal Party as having succeeded in what you call a classic passive revolutionary exercise, metabolizing and representing elements of a threatening movement to ensure political survival and, as much as possible, reestablishing electoral and policy dominance. The Calgary School was something invented a few decades ago, but today, how exactly does this definition of passive revolution, referring to the Calgary School, refer now to Mark Carney's new government? Are there, for instance, recent examples of where the Calgary School might be propping up in today's news?
Yeah, so to begin here, I'll just sort of try to clarify this concept of passive revolution and the way that I use it in the perspectives piece. So passive revolution is this concept that comes to us from Antonio Gramsci, the famous Italian Marxist political philosopher. And I'm then sort of channeling it through a Canadian historian, Ian MacKay, who uses this idea of passive revolution to talk about a big chunk of Canadian history. In MacKay's case, it's used to talk about a period of a little more than a century, from 1840 to 1950, so the middle of the 19th century to the middle of the 20th. And there, MacKay wants to say that passive revolution in governance manifests as a kind of pillaging, if you like, on the part of a ruling elite, typically, of course, the Liberal Party in this country, but not always so. But a pillaging directed at threatening political movements. So in that period, from the mid-19th century to the early 20th century, Mackay sees the radical
There's a highlight from a recent episode of the Perspectives podcast. Find out more at perspectivesjournal.ca, at broadbentinstitute.ca, and at harbingermedianetwork.com. You're listening to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. I'm Harbinger director Andre Goulet in Montreal. And finally, broadcasting for more than four decades, Red Eye presents a progressive take on current events produced by an independent media collective at Vancouver Co-op Radio. On this segment from a recent episode, BC Society for Policy Solutions analyst Véronique Siouffi joins the show to discuss the recent successful union certification drives for Uber drivers and Amazon workers in Victoria and Delta. Now, here's the show.
I'm Jane Williams. This is the Red Eye Podcast. You can hear our live broadcast on Saturday mornings from 10 till noon at 100.5 FM in the Lower Mainland. Coming up in this episode, Lorraine Chisholm speaks with Véronique Siouffi about the historic unionizing success for Amazon workers in Delta and Uber workers in Victoria.
This past summer, Uber drivers in Victoria joined UFCW 1518 to become the first platform workers in Canada to formally unionize. And Amazon warehouse workers in Delta won union certification with Unifor Local 114, becoming the second Amazon facility in Canada to unionize and only the third in North America. These two breakthrough union certifications in BC are something to celebrate. But also, we should look at what enabled these organizing victories and what barriers this kind of worker organizing faces. I'm joined by Véronique Siouffi. Véronique is the racial equity researcher and policy analyst at the BC Society for Policy Solutions. Hello, Véronique.
Hello.
So great to talk with you again.
Yeah, thanks for having me on the show again.
Now, these are historic organizing wins in areas that have long been considered unorganizable. Let's start with what happened with Uber drivers in Victoria. What did that organizing effort look like on the ground, and what difficulties were there reaching the drivers who worked for Uber?
Yeah, platform work is a very difficult industry to organize because there's no shop floor. You know, there's not like one workplace that you can kind of enter and know who all the workers are. The workers don't necessarily know who the other Uber drivers are. You know, you might know a few of your coworkers, so to speak, but it's a very, you know, what we say academically, atomized workforce, very separated, individually isolated workers. So that makes it very difficult for union organizing that kind of relies on workers knowing each other, workers having like a shared break room, some place where they can trade notes about their experiences of work and what it's like and why they might want to organize in the first place. And so that, you know, right off the bat makes it very difficult to organize. And then as an employer, Uber definitely doesn't make it any easier. You know, there's no built-in tools for drivers to contact each other. So, you know, they like to keep the workers separated. But then they also make it very difficult for unions to know how many workers there are to organize in the first place. So as this organizing drive in Victoria got off the ground, Uber made different claims at different times about how many workers there really were, because part of organizing a workforce is reaching a certain threshold of workers that sign union cards.
For those of us who have followed efforts to unionize Amazon workers, the win for warehouse workers in Delta was stunning.
Mm-hmm.
What did the battle to organize look like there?
Yeah, similar to what Uber did, Amazon did the same thing of, you know, Uber claimed to have a lot more drivers than they did, which made it difficult for the union to say, hey, we reached that 55% threshold of workers that signed the union card. Amazon did a similar thing. You know, you'd think it'd be easier because they're in a warehouse. They do have that, you know, uniform workplace that they all go to. They know who each other are. And what Amazon did once workers started to sign union cards and talk to a union was do a hiring blitz. So, you know, where the union thought maybe they have 55% of the workforce have signed union cards, which is that threshold they need to meet. Amazon was like, no, actually, we have this many more workers than you really thought, suddenly hiring a bunch more workers. And the board decided that that was a clear union busting effort and that they didn't really need those workers at that time, that that was specifically a hiring blitz designed to make that union drive invalid.
So Veronique, one of the recent provincial labor policy reforms that helped these two unionizing drives to succeed was single step union certification or card check. How does that help workers to organize?
Yeah, that means that's that 55% I keep talking about, where you need to get at least 55% of the workers at any given work site to sign union membership cards, which means, you know, the worker is saying, I do want representation by a union, you know, I want to democratize my workplace, and I think this will benefit me. And so you need to reach that 55% threshold. What we had for a while was a two-step certification, which means after that whole union drive, which as we saw with both Uber and Amazon is already so difficult in the first place, it made a second step where after that initial step, you know, there's like a period of time where then you have to again get a secret ballot vote where all the workers get to vote on whether they want to do a union or not, sign on to a union or not. But of course, what that does is give an extra period of time for the employer to apply new union busting tactics. You know, this is where now that they know that the workers are trying to organize, they get to intervene and, you know, scare the workers with all the consequences that might happen if they try to unionize. Maybe we'll close this workplace. Maybe we'll lay you all off, or, you know, your work conditions will worsen, your pay will worsen, you know, all these kind of disinformation campaign and threats to scare workers off of unionizing. And so it made a job that's already very difficult for workers to get union representation, it made it that much harder. So it's great that we, as of 2022, have single step card check back.
Yeah, quite a major difference there. Now, with the Uber drivers, a key reform that you cite is the reclassification of ride-hailing gig workers in the food delivery area that happened in 2023 here in BC. Remind us what Bill 48 did to guarantee some of the benefits of being an employee under the ESA, the Employment Standards Act.
Right. I mean, the big thing that it did is, first of all, if you want to unionize, you have to be a worker. And Uber drivers were not considered workers by the platform. They were classified as independent contractors. So a big thing that Bill 48 did was define these workers, including food delivery workers, ride hail drivers, platform workers, in other words, as employees, and the platforms as employers. So, you know, that means that the Employment Standards Act gets to apply to them. Of course, exceptions were made, which I was disappointed by. So not all of the rights under the Employment Standards Act apply to these workers, but they did get things like a minimum pay floor. It doesn't match minimum wage exactly. They got 120% of minimum wage just for the hours that they're engaged. So, you know, if you look up my research online, you'll see my complaints that this doesn't really add up to a minimum wage necessarily, because workers spend a lot of time driving around waiting for a job. But a few other protections with some exceptions. You know, they don't have sick days, they don't have vacation pay, no overtime, none of those kind of protections. But at the very least, they got considered and defined as employees.
How does what happened in BC with Uber drivers compare with other jurisdictions like California and New York City?
Yeah, that was why Bill 48 was such a important step, is that we saw already, you know, ahead of Bill 48 coming through in 2023 here in BC, we saw how much money the platform companies poured into what's called Prop 22, which was to kind of lock in that contractor status for Uber drivers, for food delivery workers, for all sorts of workers, actually. Uber put $200 million at least into Prop 22. And, you know, this means that those workers, you know, might find other ways to push for legislative protections, but they cannot collectively bargain. They can't unionize. They're not workers. They're considered independent contractors. And the same things happened in New York City. Ride-hail drivers, like Uber drivers, have some regulatory protections that they fought for, but they don't have somebody representing them. They don't have that democratic workplace representation because they remain classified as independent contractors under the law. So that, you know, prevents them having access to collective bargaining rights.
Veronique, what is sectoral bargaining and how could it change the playing field here?
Yeah, what we argue for at BC Policy Solutions is for an opening up of the ways in which workers are allowed to organize. So we have what's called the Labor Relations Code, and this is essentially a set of regulations, a set of limitations of the conditions under which workers are allowed to unionize. That's not any worker can unionize under any circumstance. It's actually a very limited set of rules. And these rules are supposed to be to keep the balance between employers and workers and keep the peace and keep the public interest. So it's not kind of chaos out there with employers taking too much advantage of workers and workers, you know, rebelling and striking willy-nilly, let's say. So this sets limits on when workers can strike, how workers can organize. It's very limited because it was designed for a different era of work. Work has just changed so much since we set out the limitations on how workers organize, which is a kind of worksite by worksite. It's called the enterprise model. It's a worksite by worksite approach where for back in the day when most people may have worked, let's say, on a factory floor where you have hundreds of employees under one employer.
It was a new interview from Red Eye. Hear more of their high-quality public affairs and arts programming every Saturday from 10 to noon PST at CFRO 100.5 FM in Vancouver. And find all their new interviews at harbingermedianetwork.com. You've been listening to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. This episode has been brought to you by Unrigged. Learn more about Canada's coalition of more than 30 progressive publishers and get all your independent Canadian journalism, including news, videos, and podcasts, in one place at unrigged.ca. Follow us on Twitter at Harbinger Tweets and on Instagram at Media Harbinger and now Blue Sky for updates on new episodes. And subscribe to the Harbinger newsletter for a weekly Wednesday roundup from Canada's cross-country community of 83 socially and politically progressive podcasts. We'll be back with a new episode next week. Until then, I'm Harbinger Director Andre Goulet in Montreal. Now back to your regularly scheduled community radio station programming.
Yo, this is Black Tai Chi, the mic conductor, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM in B Baby, BC.
This is Bird Note. The wall of birds at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology is a towering mural showing nearly 250 life-sized birds across a map of the world. It took artist Jane Kim 17 long months to paint.
It was a very solitary experience. Sometimes it was almost lonely or isolating because there was no one who was able to share that experience with me of painting day in and day out, sometimes 7 days a week. So like those birds all kind of became my friends.
And not just the birds Jane illustrated. Speakers throughout the building let visitors hear sounds of wildlife from the surrounding nature sanctuary. In her book about the Wall of Birds, Jane reflected on how that soundscape connected her to the outside world.
I'd paint in the lift for hours and hours, oblivious to the passing time, until the caterwauling calls of a barred owl, like a giant squeegee being dragged across a window, echoed through the lobby and interrupted my reverie. During those two frequent all-nighters, the rolling trill of red-winged blackbirds announcing the dawn informed me it was time to retire. The chorus often brought to mind the words of Claude Monet. I would like to paint the way a bird sings. On my walk to the car through the sharp morning air, I couldn't help wishing I could sing like them too.
See photos from the Wall of Birds when you visit our website, birdnote.org. I'm Mark Bramhill.